Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel tennis podcast brought to you by Laver Cup. No, they're not really a sponsor, but it did seem as though everyone in tennis was singing the praise of this weekend-long competition that happened in Chicago at the United Center over the weekend. I had the good fortune of spending a day and a half there, and this event is legit. They get a lot of right on a lot of levels. To me, funny that barely 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks after the U.S. Open, we have another event that really pierces the public consciousness. Fun to spend some time in Chicago, and we're going to break down the Laver Cup right now with Paul Anacone, former coach of Roger Federer, current Tennis Channel analyst, also working with Taylor Fritz. Paul was in Chicago all weekend, and we talk Laver Cup. Actually, we'll do it right now. I feel like we can skip the step and say, how did you like it? Everyone likes Laver Cup. It's like George Clooney and Tom Hanks. There's no dissenting opinion. You liked it. I could tell by your response.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I loved it.
Big success. No one's denying that. No one's debating that. What is it to you? Why has this thing worked, and why has it worked so quickly?
I mean, it's amazing after being in Chicago for 4 days. I remember the first day I walked in and I saw the size of the United Center, and I thought, okay, the United States September tennis after the U.S. Open right. In an 18,000-seat venue, this might be a challenge.
Cubs-White Sox weekend?
Exactly. And then I wake up the first day, you know, Friday morning, and it's Friday, a work day at 1 o'clock, and it's packed. And I could not believe the level of passion and intensity from the fans, which was incredible. I mean, it was amazing to see that. And it, from start to finish, Friday through Sunday. So I think there's a lot of ingredients, but really for me, most of it is driven by the intensity from the players. You know, people were worried last year, are these guys really going to try? What's it going to be like? And we saw it. And Jimmy Arias said the best thing. He said, you know how important it is to a player when you see if they're choking. And Jimmy said, everybody's choking. And so I really think that, you know, the leaders, the best players, like last year, the highest ranked players like Roger and Rafa, you know, they led by example. They were out there, you know, really doing what they could to win matches. And it's the same this year with Novak, and with Novak trying so hard. And he went down in his matches but fought his butt off. Roger was digging in, trying to win doubles matches. You know, and then you see John Isner coming off, just becoming a dad, just diving and doing. I mean, it's led by the passion from the players. And that gets that huge crowd engaged. And then, you know, you can talk about all the other miscellaneous stuff, right? You know, tennis is such a traditional sport, but gosh, John, you look at the match tiebreak and you look at the intensity with players winning matches in a match tiebreak and flipping the score after a tiebreak in the second set, and then the quick turnaround and another group of players comes out. You know, you combine that scoring system with the fact that your whole team is sitting behind the bench. And oh, by the way, Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe are sitting on the benches. So, I mean, it's unbelievable. I never thought it would be this big this quickly. And I give so much credit, you know, to teammate, you know, Tony Gottsick's company and Roger, and also Tennis Australia, who, I mean, flew in, you know, half of their staff to basically run and manage it as well. So it was unbelievable. It really was.
I don't know if people at home could also appreciate the production value. I mean, we were there the day they were setting up, and there's a spider cam, and there's a net cam, and there's, you know, exercise equipment in the locker room. I thought the professionalism and the entire production setup, more than millions of dollars for a, you know, 3-day event. Let's go back to the players, though, because I agree with you. I think that choking line is really telling, and I think you're right. You saw that. You saw nerves that you don't see. I never mind at other exhibitions. I mean, I saw a level of intensity that you don't see necessarily at other tournaments. But I'm still hung up on, why is that? Is it we all want the respect of our peers?
It's really, I think it's very simple, and the only thing I can equate it with is is Davis Cup, is that these players all grow up their whole life playing for themselves. You know, you grow up as an individual. And so very rarely do you get into an environment where you are in a group where you feel responsible for a team. And so all of a sudden you get put on a team and you see and hear your teammates on the sideline just, you know, really into it, the pep talk in the locker room. I mean, you're David Goffin, you're sitting there on the bench next to Borg, and then Roger comes up behind you and starts giving you coaching advice. I mean, it is just ramped up pressure. It's ramped up set of consequences in your mind, and I think the majority of it is driven by that team concept because it's so difficult to emulate that, and in an individual sport, tennis players don't have to deal with it their whole life. I mean, the first time I played, I only played one Davis Cup tie in Australia, and I literally injured my shoulder serving because I was so nervous. I was so tight, I couldn't, you know, that sense of playing for a team and my country in Davis Cup, I've never felt anything like that in my life. So that's why when you combine the team atmosphere with the great players and the great man, Rod Laver, that this is named after, and the intensity the players have, these guys are nervous. I mean, the last 3 points Roger played against John Isner, you know, I've seen him hit a lot of forehands. Those were steered forehands.
Right.
He was steering the ball in the court. I mean, and this is a guy that's won 20 majors. And so everyone gets nervous. And I love the fact that the players have to conquer those nerves. So for me, it's just it's really spectacular.
I'll tell you, I think four of the 12 matches, I think, had match points squandered. You know, Diego Schwartzman had match points against Goffin and didn't close. Have you ever heard the rattlesnake experiment in psychology, social psychology?
No.
They take kids and they divide them into groups. You're the cougars and you're the rattlesnakes, or rattlers, uh-huh. I think they call them. And there's no basis for the division, but within, you know, whatever, half an hour of being on these two different teams, you have some very serious feelings about the people on your team, sort of in group. And you have very negative feelings about the people out of group. So they say to these kids, you know, someone stole a candy bar and he was a rattler. And the rattler's like, oh, let him off. It's only shoplifting. And the people on the other team say, that's serious business. He should, you know, be grounded for a month. And the point is that we form these bonds based on very little. So someone has, you know, hey, someone's born in October and you love that person. Someone
right.
has your initials. And it struck me. This is a long way of saying I'm not sure this Europe versus the world particularly matters. I mean, I don't necessarily. England's trying to break away from the EU, and I'm not sure John Isner has particularly strong feelings for Diego Schwartzman as a world member that he would not have for. I mean, to me, what was interesting too is it's not Davis Cup where everyone's playing for one team in one country. These distinctions. It's a little bit of eeny, meeny, miny, mo, isn't it? I mean, I'm not sure Europe, not
it
sure
is.
Players
no,
on
no,
tour.
You're,
and,
you're,
does
you're,
that make sense?
You're 100% right. I saw some people criticizing, you know, they got to get rid of the rest of the world thing, or they've got to. And I'm just like, well, why? I mean, what? I mean, just look at, you know, look, I went to the opening night gala, and I saw these guys introduce each other, and I saw Isner and Schwartzman give each other a bit, you know, Schwartzman introduced Isner as his twin,
right,
you know,
right,
and he gave
right.
him a big hug. And it, you know, you're right. They build a bond so quickly. And I think some of that is because the players also are starved for that, you know, team camaraderie. I mean, look
right.
at Nick Kyrgios, John, how much have we talked about, you know, his inability to stay consistently motivated. He's unbelievable in a team environment. I mean, he's the guy that's out there the most, cheering and pulling his teammates up. And, I mean, he loves this. So you throw these guys on teams and expectations are magnified, pressure's magnified, peer pressure's magnified, the sense of loss and consequences are magnified. And all this, when you throw it in an arena like they did in Chicago, which was fully packed and which was produced to the nines, makes it unbelievable. I mean, it was just top of the line.
I'm telling you, it's so how much of this is great event? I think it's very buttoned up. players like it. It's got a lot of forces going for it. And how much of this is, wait a second, maybe we need to step back and really reassess tennis? You mentioned the match tiebreak. Other players, I mean, other people have mentioned the emphasis on doubles. We're talking about a team environment. I mean, I wonder how much we should be thinking macro at this event. And what lessons do we take away for Cincinnati?
Yeah. It definitely begs the question, doesn't it? I mean, look, I'm a dinosaur. I'm a traditionalist. I want 3 out of 5 in the majors. I do want tie breaks in the fifth set, but I want 3 out of 5 in the majors. You know, I'm a traditionalist, but I tell you what, you go to an environment like that and you spend 3 days there and you listen and feel an 18,000 seat venue shake and you watch players knees buckle under pressure and you sweat in your palms while you're watching matches, it definitely makes you think, and it makes you wonder about scoring system and what works in the future. And look, I think there's room for everything. I really do. But by virtue of having this special situation kind of stick out, for me, it makes me go, okay, Davis Cup, now what are you guys thinking? You know, okay,
exactly.
You know, Fed Cup,
exactly.
Okay, Fed Cup, okay, World Team Cup. Now what are you guys thinking? I mean, to me, this type of format really, you know, lights a candle of question in the minds of so many. And like I said, I am a traditionalist, but, you know, we saw how many feathers were ruffled by tweaking the Davis Cup format pretty significantly, you know, 2 out of 3 sets, 1 week in the year. And that's one of the issues with having such a fractured tennis governing structure that we have, is that there are so many different opinions and none of them are wrong. They're just different. But one of the curses that we've fought our whole lives in tennis is the inability to be fluid, the inability to be malleable and be open to other possibilities. And I think that this definitely, you know, flicks that light bulb in your mind of, there is room for stuff like this. Does it mean it should be everything? Probably not, but it gives us something to talk about, that's for sure. And it gives it opportunity to do things a little bit differently. And that's why I don't want to suffocate or smother Davis Cup right away, or say, wow, this is the greatest thing for Davis Cup right away. Because I think you have to see what happens. Because like I said, John, I was in the car, you know, 8 years ago with Roger and Tony Godsick when they started talking about this, and Roger going, you know, we really should do something for Rod Laver and that generation, and blah. And I remember how excited he was about it. And I was like, how's it even going to work? How are you going to make this fit? You know, and then, you know, so what happened in Prague last year, and then to physically be in the United Center, my jaw is still kind of dragging on the ground. I couldn't believe the level of intensity and the level of passion and just the fulfillment of all the fans and the sponsors and the play. I mean, it was they didn't miss a beat. It was really incredible.
Don't you think the fans sort of took their cue from the players as well? And if these guys had handed,
that drives it, you know, that drives it. If they're out there kidding around and not caring, right, then it's different. But the fans saw from day one, you know, they saw day one, these guys really giving 110%. They saw, you know, Roger and Novak losing doubles the first day. You know, they saw, you know, Francis Tiafoe, you know, go down to Dimitrov, but digging and scraping and scrounging, and they just got into it, and then they took the lead of the players. So if the players compete and they fight and there's intensity, and let's give Chicago a little clap, all right? I mean, they haven't had pro tennis in so many years. This is an amazing city that loves tennis. You know, this is an amazing city with a great fan base. And they just took it and ran with it. And it was so much fun to be a part of.
The one thing I think bodes well for Davis Cup is that, you know, Roger went to Chicago, I think with Kyrgios, in between Indian Wells and Miami. So that was already, I mean, that was 6 months of buildup. And they ate deep dish pizza and they went to the Bean in Millennium Park and they saw the Frank Gehry and they sort of got their photo ops in. The way Davis Cup works, you don't have that luxury. You can't 6 months out say, here's the date, here's the surface, here's the venue, here's where it's going to be. So the fact that you had all this time for Chicago to get behind, we already know Laver Cup 3 is going to be in Geneva. I think the 12 months out buildup is a huge advantage. It occurred to me that's something this new reformed Davis Cup I think can really benefit from. That it's not, yeah, well, 100%. If Croatia wins, we've got to cross an ocean and play on clay. But if Australia wins, we're going to cross a different ocean and might play on indoors. I mean, I think the fact that you have this lead time is something that's really going to benefit this new Davis Cup.
Yeah, it should, right? You know in November where, where it's going to be, and at least four of the teams that are going to be there. So you can start marketing that, and the other stuff is going to be decided in February, right, with the home and away ties in February. So you have a foundation to build on. That's why I don't want to sledgehammer the Davis Cup totally right now. They're trying to figure it out. This is a start and a step in a direction. Is this going to be the end game? Probably not. But what worries me more, John, is just the confluence of all of the different team competitions right now. What's going to happen with Davis Cup, with ATP World Cup, with Laver Cup? How are we going to, again, this fractured community that we live in tennis, and everyone trying to be proprietary about what they want, makes it a challenge. And that's why our leaders all have to be open-minded, expansive thinkers, and God forbid, be a little bit selfless for the betterment of the game. So there's a lot of stuff to be worked out, but you hit the nail on the head about Davis Cup. One of the good things now is, okay, four of the teams that are going to be there in November. Let's try to figure out how to do some preliminary sponsorship stuff, some preliminary build-up. And you mentioned, last February, Laver Cup, Roger and Kyrgios and John McEnroe and Rod, they were in Chicago having deep dish pizza, meeting Rahm Emanuel and going through the city and shaking hands with kids and doing some grassroots stuff. And I tell you what, that doesn't fall on deaf ears, and we saw the result of that this weekend.
Also, I did not see a lot of fans saying, boy, this was great, but I wish they played best out of five. I wish there were a good 4.5-hour match sandwiched in there. I did not hear too many fans feeling shortchanged. Let me ask you, were there tennis takeaways? I mean, did you walk out of there saying whatever it was? I mean, boy, X player impressed me, or Diego Schwartzman didn't close those match points, or Djokovic lost more matches over the weekend in Chicago than he has since the French Open. Right. Were there any sort of on-court, between-the-lines tennis takeaways that struck you?
Like I started off in our conversation, it's just, as a tennis person, for me, it's just amazing to see pressure very, very tangibly. And you don't always see that. And it was magnified this weekend. And like I said, I saw Roger get nervous. I saw Novak get nervous. I saw Isner get nervous. I saw everybody have to deal with a different kind of nerves. I saw Sasha Zverev get very nervous and double faults. And I saw him have to fight through it against Kevin Anderson. I saw Kevin play unbelievably, flawless against Novak. And I saw Novak get a little bit tight. And then I saw Kevin Anderson get tight against Zverev in the last match. So it's the seesaw of the players battling the emotional fluctuations from ecstasy to the disaster of losing and having to wrestle that in their own mind. So for me to see that as a tennis person, I guess it's a little bit sadistic, but I'd love to watch them try to figure that stuff out. And that adds to the drama. That adds to the moment. I didn't come away with any huge different feelings about any of the players because the environment was so different.
Right.
But it was a group of great players that all seemed to embrace the moment in their own way. And the more you're in that situation, the better you're going to get at it, whether it's Davis Cup or Laver Cup. So I think for the young players, it's the most difficult. I think Jack struggled in singles. He's been struggling, this year in singles anyway. But look, to me, it's so hard to take one or two little ingredients without looking at the whole end result, the whole end product. And that end product is unbelievable.
Do you bring it back to Chicago in 2 years?
Can
you do that? Well, I mean, the flip side would say, listen, it's it's the rest of the world. Never mind Chicago. We shouldn't even have it in the U.S. in 2 years. But
I don't know how you turn your back on it. Look, I wouldn't be. I say why not, just in terms of I'm still trying to catch my breath from the arena and the venue and the fan support. But like you mentioned, John, if they go out and they promote it and you know they go to South America and they get the passionate fans down there and Del Potro's playing, and I mean I think it works everywhere. I mean, I think you get it's a star-driven sport. You get the stars there, and you get that kind of environment. It's going to work, and you get the production value, you know, that teammate put out there with Tennis Australia and the other partners. That's going to work anywhere. It can't not work unless they just manage it really, really poorly, which I don't see happening now.
Here come the hard questions. You can let me do the dirty work.
All right.
It seems to me this was in many ways also a Roger Federer appreciation, and you saw a lot of fans with RF apparel, as you might expect to. You saw a lot of Roger's sponsors. Obviously, this was done under the auspices of his management group. He, I think, very much took on the role of host. He was very gracious. He was very sort of accommodating. When is he not? But does this work without Roger Federer? If this is Kevin Anderson against Luca Puig, does this work?
I don't think it works without the superstars. And whether it's Roger, you know, it doesn't work without Roger Novak or Roger Rafa or Andy. And look, let's be clear here. I mean, Roger's Roger, you know, and Rafa have kind of separated themselves, I think kind of unfairly, because Novak Djokovic is one of the greatest players in the history of the game.
Right.
I mean, he is unbelievable with what he's done on a tennis court and with his foundation, and he's expanded as a human being and as a person. I feel, if this sounds really bizarre, but I feel badly for Novak that he's in the Rafa and Roger era.
I really do. In more ways than one. Totally agree.
It's unbelievable. And he walks on the court and he gets a raucous ovation, and then they introduce Roger right next to it and the roof almost blows off.
Right.
And it's just, you know, but that's human nature, right? That's what happens. It's, you know, it's like the great young baseball player, you know, that gets introduced right before Hank Aaron back in the day, or someone that gets, you know, it would be like Stephen Curry getting introduced right before Michael Jordan comes on.
Right.
You know, it's just so difficult to deal with that. I think Novak's had to unfairly deal with that, because that's just human nature. But at the end of the day, it will come out in the wash. I mean, the guy's won two majors this year. I'm avoiding the question a little bit, but not really. The thing that I want to say is it's a star-driven sport. The stars have to be there. Do they all have to be there? Clearly not. Rafa wasn't there this year. But if Roger and Rafa weren't there and it was just Novak, that would be more challenging in the U.S. I think the more of those stars you have, the better. But if you have two of them, if you have Roger and Novak or Novak and Rafa in Europe, I think those things work. Nothing will be as impactful without the most recognizable person there. And probably Roger's the most recognizable person right now.
Right.
So it's like, you know, it would be like doing it with all the stars except Serena. You know, and she's so monumentally bigger than everyone else, it's going to be an impact. But I think you can do it as long as you have some of the stars. You can't do it without them, though.
You know what else struck me? Jump in here, which is you mentioned Tennis Australia. I mean, the USTA also has a multi-million dollar investment in this.
Yep.
This strikes me as a real challenge to the majors. I mean, recently the majors have gotten very, very strong, the 410 poles that rise high above everything else. More so than a Masters 1000, more so than mixed events, Indian Wells even. This strikes me as something that could really challenge the majors. It's a completely different format. It's not seven rounds. It's 3 days. It's not prize money and points. But I just thought it was funny to see this sort of investment from the USTA and Tennis Australia when I think this event could really be a disruptor to their business. Their business model.
I would disagree a little bit, John, because I think it's so different. Because the majors are 128 draw over 2 weeks, I actually think it's less of a disruptor and more of, it's hard to say this, I don't mean this in a tongue-in-cheek way, but it's more of the side dish. It's more of the great salad next to the beautiful steak and lobster, which are the, you know, I don't think it's as much of a disruptor because number one, of where it is in the calendar, and number two, I actually think the format's so different that I don't think it would threaten the majors because of that. That's how I look at it, but I might be off base, but that's just kind of my sense of it. And I think that's probably why the USTA and Tennis Australia are involved, because they see it as something so different. It's not something that's 14 days. It's men and women, that it's just driven by the federations, that it's, you know, right, I don't look at it that way. My bigger concern really is just, last time I checked, there's 52 weeks in the calendar, that's, and I don't think there's going to be any more added anytime soon. That's what worries me
challenge.
Most.
Yeah, this is, and you know, I mean, I'll tell you, the gossip is there are a number of entities gunning for this September date, and Laver Cup will have to defend its turf. The tennis calendar rears its head again. You mentioned women. Is there any reason this couldn't be dual gendered?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I would like to see how it would work. I'd like to see what the, you know, what do you do then? Do you just have, do you have six men and six women? Do you have four and five? You know, I'd like to hear the conversations about the pros and cons of it. Could you imagine though if Serena
That's
was there
exactly,
as well,
Serena
and Venus and Simona Halep and Sloane's there, and you have Pliskova, and you know you have right. the other Muguruza, the other major. I mean, boy, oh boy. I mean, talk about a product. Holy cow. I mean, I'd like to hear how the, I mean, I haven't given the format consideration at all, but I'd love to hear about it, and it could be spectacular. And if it isn't, if it doesn't do that, you know, should the women be entertaining this? I mean,
well, that's
I
what I,
you.
Yeah, maybe they do that separately. Maybe, and yeah. Apparently the USTA is looking into this. There might be some Billie Jean King involvement, but no, why, you know, Serena and Naomi Osaka playing doubles against Wozniacki and Halep.
Right.
I'm watching that.
Yeah, why not? And you know, have Billie Jean King up there on the,
exactly.
on the mantle. I mean, it's well deserved, and it's something that makes a ton of sense. I mean, if I were, you know, the women, I would be thinking about why. Boy, this would be great for us, and I think it's a great platform.
All right, let me ask you this too, which struck me as a thought exercise, but does this event work? I think a lot of this event is predicated, what you said, on players or individuals, but these guys especially really seem to be team sports fans, whether it's Roger, Rafa and Soccer, Isner, Sock, go down the list. But I also, there is a certain camaraderie and warmth among the top players that I'm not sure has always been there. Would an event like this have worked in your era where you did not necessarily have this amity among the stars? You think you guys would have gotten behind this?
I mean, I don't think so. But also in my era and the era just after that, there was less of a fracture between Davis Cup and team stuff and the individual things. So I don't know that it would have been as welcomed. In other words, I think Davis Cup back then had more prominence than it does right now. Maybe prominence is probably a bad word. Maybe more visibility and perceived accolades outside of the industry than it does right now. And so maybe there wasn't the opportunity then. But I think you're right. I think because, look, let's be honest, you know, we saw the prize money increases in slams, and who drove that? Roger and Rafa and Novak and Andy, and they all talk together. So they can work together. They can do stuff together. So to me, if I'm the tennis community, it's great that the top guys are united, but it's also a little scary, if you ask me.
I got because, a kick out of this with, I mean, if you looked at the various sort of the matrix of the big four, and I think this is an open secret. I would say the one with the most friction is probably Roger and Novak, of all the dimensions you could go with the big four. And even those two guys, you know, the wives are posing for selfies and they're hugging each other and they're playing doubles, and Novak hits Roger in the waist and they both giggle about it. When the relationship with the most friction is Roger and Novak, I think that says an awful lot about the level of respect and fondness that these four guys have. And I got to think that trickles down to the rest of the field. If the big four can all have this civility, when you're Nick Kyrgios, are you really going to have a beef with another player at your level?
Right. No, they look, and it's just like life, right? Leaders, you know, when they lead by example, it's much easier to follow. It's like what I said to you about, you know, about the competition. When these other guys see Roger and Rafa and Novak diving and scraping and scrounging and frustrated and banging rackets and exulting in joy, I'm not going to go out there and not try. Are
right,
you?
Right, right. The leader sets the culture.
Yeah, so they set the culture, and you're right. You know, and Roger and Novak, look, they talked about it. Novak was coaching Roger when he was playing. Roger was coaching Novak. They played doubles together. I just think that it's so great to see the unification. My point was, you know, whenever players talk about player issues, and you see those four with the ability to communicate and collaborate,
There's a lot
of power there. There's a lot of possibility.
It's a good block. That's a really good point. I mean, we didn't even talk about the coaching. I never thought I'd see Kyle Edmund shouting out some really sound strategic advice to guys ranked ahead of him. What else you got the rest of the year? I mean, are you tennis, it's always weird, right?
The rest of the year, I've got, you know, we got some Asian Swing we're going to take care of over at Tennis Channel, which will be a lot of fun. I'm going to spend a little time with Taylor Fritz and David Nankin. David does all the heavy lifting. And then, you know me, John, I jump in and grab the glory. And then when he's not winning, I say, geez, it's David's fault.
Yeah, they need me on the set. I'm doing hair and makeup need me.
Exactly.
If you're Taylor Fritz or a player of his caliber, how big a deal is it for you to is he setting a sight on playing Laver Cup in 2019?
Oh yeah. He would love to play Laver Cup. I mean, he would love to play Laver Cup. And I've got to tell you, I have received more texts from people and tennis people about the level and enthusiasm from last weekend than I've ever gotten in my. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but I've had people say I've never seen anything like that. And it was the most fun 3 days I've ever seen in tennis. So, yeah, I think the players are going to want to participate. They're going to want to be involved. And I just think the event's going to get bigger and better.
I love Nick Kyrgios' line. If only there were one of these every week, I'd be so much more
exactly.
engaged with the sport.
That's the cure. That's the cure for Nick. That's the cure for Nick. Yeah. He'd have the passion to do it consistently.
All right. No, good event. Pleasure working with you as always. Oh, by the way, hey, last question. And I don't say this to be a smart. I'm dead serious. Who do you think won our bet? You and I had a bit of a disagreement over whether Roger and Novak would be a superior team to Sock and Anderson.
No, you won.
And
I
didn't
bet.
Honestly, I was flying back. Yeah, I didn't see the match.
Yeah, because well, the question was who's the favorite, and
right.
I favored Roger and Novak, and you know what's interesting? You definitely won. So did we bet dinner or anything?
No,
nah,
come on.
For that?
No, it was a gentleman's bet.
No, but no. The interesting thing is, you know what I didn't take into consideration, which was very naive of me, a little bit of the Mickelson-Tiger Woods syndrome playing together, is that when you have two greats like that, it's very difficult to figure out. I think it's more difficult to figure out a role. For instance, when I watched Roger play with Sasha Zverev on Sunday, he was crossing, he was trying to take over, he was trying to be a little bit more of the alpha. And then when you have Roger and Novak, who's supposed to have that role? Who's supposed to? It's a very interesting dynamic. But no, Jack won all three of his doubles matches, and he played great doubles. You know, he's the modern day doubles guy, but I think we gotta be careful because Mike Bryan, you know, he's pretty darn good, and I'm not so sure I'm gonna say Jack's the best doubles player in the world. I would say Jack might be the best modern doubles guy right now, if we shortchange Mike, we do it at our own peril.
I you know what's funny about Jack Sock, as long as you brought him up, his singles game incorporates not a lot of his doubles expertise. I mean, he has great. I mean, singles game is is what it is, right? I mean, it's a big forehand, good athlete, hits a nice serve. His doubles game is sort of filled with risk-taking at the net and these clever, great set of hands, but also some really clever angles. I don't know if he just – I mean, we told him that he came to the set and we talked about that and said, boy, you're great at doubles, and he was a little sheepish about it and was clearly, you know, listen, I'd much rather we were talking about my singles.
Yeah, I think he's one of those guys that's much more naturally gifted at doubles. And I can tell you, I mean, I was not Jack Sock at all, but I got to 3 in the world in doubles and 12 in singles. Doubles was way easier for me. I always felt, I mean, it was just, I didn't question myself nearly as much. It came much more naturally. The points are quicker. There's less heavy lifting. And dare I say, in doubles, there tends to be less prolonged problem solving. Doubles is more instinctive. It happens more quickly. It happens in a time frame that's very, very, very short. In singles, particularly in today's day and age, you have to be really resilient mentally, and you have to be really able to think on your feet for prolonged periods of time without letting emotional things drive what conclusions you come to. That's a challenge. That's tough.
It sounds like two different sports. I bet if you'd said at the beginning of the year, Jack Sock currently in the top 10, on October 1st will have made more money in doubles than in singles this year. You would wonder exactly how
shocking.
That was going to break. Anyway,
I mean, that's just that's shocking. And look, he's a great player. He just needs to get his confidence back because his average level has been so misleading this year. I mean, his average level on a bad year, he should be 30 in the world on a bad year. And if he keeps going, he's going to be outside the top 100. So, I mean, that to me is almost, it's such an aberration. He just needs to have, you know, he needs to have some hard conversations with himself, and he needs to find a pool of relentless optimism that does not get shaken when he plays in matches.
Right.
And that just is going to take a little bit of time.
Man, you go to Australia as a top 10 seed, you go back the following year, and you have to qualify, but you have won two straight majors in doubles. It's been an interesting interesting 12 months for Jack Sock. All right, go enjoy California. I've kept you long enough.
Thanks,
this was great,
God.
This was great.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, thanks a lot, you guys.
All right, thanks to Paul Anacone for spending some time with us talking Laver Cup. Great event. And again, I encourage the tennis powers that be, such as they are, to really take a long, hard look at what worked and what didn't. Things like coaching and scoring and time of match and optics presentation. I think a lot of that really ought to be considered in a broader discussion. Anyway, Jamie Lasanti, you were listening to that conversation. You watch much Laver Cup?
Yeah, a little bit. Watched a lot of, as you said, the tennis community chatting about everything on Twitter. As you said, everyone was really into it.
I don't say this facetiously. Did anyone have material objections? Was anyone sort of non-snarkily... complaints? I mean, it's hard to find fault.
People who weren't there were probably mad that they weren't there. I wanted to ask you, you talked about it a lot with Paul, but being there, what was kind of one thing that you took away from the event or that you didn't realize, happened at the event until you actually got to be there and see it?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, the players sort of, this is not an exhibition, was a talking point before the first Laver Cup. I mean, that's always been clearly something that's been very important to the organizers. This is not hit and giggle. This is not let the ball kids play a point for you. But you can only fake it so much. And I saw more intensity. And some of that was what Paul was talking about during the matches. But some of that was just the players got in early and they did their workouts and they brought their hitting partners from home. You know, Kyle Edmund, I mean, players were bringing in their coaches, who keep in mind had just, in a lot of cases, crossed oceans to spend 2 weeks at the U.S. Open. Mm-hmm. There was an exercise bike where players got a sweat going before they took the court. They were stretching. Novak had his bands. Never mind the match itself and going the extra effort to dig up that ball in the corner. I mean, the way they approached the whole weekend was so professional. You really did have this unshakable sense that it really mattered to these players. I also think that something that gets lost is how much we all, and I think this is true for just about any profession, how much people want and crave and need and value the respect of their peers. These were
That's a good point.
You know, we're talking about 12 players. These are the best in the world. This was, nobody wanted to be humiliated. This isn't the NBA All-Star game where everybody's there for a good time and the party the night before and the party. I think it really mattered to these players that they give a good accounting of themselves in front of their peers. And some of that meant face-to-face, so the player on the other side of the net. But I think these players, these are their colleagues. They're also their opponents. I think they all wanted the rest of the field to respect their tennis, the way they went about their job, their level of professionalism. If you were a joke, if there were 11 guys there who were putting in their work and one guy's blowing it off, that's going to have all sorts of, players are going to remember that.
You can't go there and go on vacation. You're there to prove yourself.
I think, and if you did go on vacation, I think that would be really to your competitive detriment later on. I mean, this was a way for players really to see how the other guys work out, how they conduct their business, how they practice in a way that you probably don't have at a conventional
tournament.
It's a weird dynamic. The whole thing was a weird
boys
dynamic.
Club of there was a definitely test weekend kind of thing.
There was, I like that. That sounds like a reality show.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I'm thinking. Like, you're there on vacation, but you're actually here to really
you
prove something.
Your medal. Yeah, exactly.
It's funny you mentioned the All-Star game because I did get some vibes of that. And only because it seemed very... because there are no ranking points and things like that, because there's so much kind of freedom in a way and they're joking around a lot. And I guess because you see the players interact, it's kind of like the All-Star game where, I mean, you don't really ever get to see LeBron James and Kevin Durant kind of like just hanging out. Right. And so this brings that for tennis. But it's interesting that you say that unlike the All-Star game, they're very much into this and it's not just emotion in a fun way, but it's kind of passion and emotion in like a I want to win, I need to play good type of way.
And it's everything. I mean, it was the catering in the players' locker room. It was this team of stringers. Maybe you go to a regular exhibition, they don't have 12 guys frantically stringing rackets.
Is that because Federer is hosting the party? Is that from...
No, I mean, I do think that Federer played this outside role in the whole thing, and I think a lot of people took their cue from him, and a lot of the sponsors were his sponsors, and I do think my one concern is when X years from now, and you hope it's 20, but when Roger Federer is no longer a participant, does this lose a little bit? But no, I thought it was really kind of fascinating, just the whole psychology of it. I mean, I figure a social psychologist would have a field day with team versus individual and a lot of sort of the alpha male stuff we were talking about what motivates these players. They're getting paid the same amount whether they lose 0-0 or whether they win the trophy. There are no ranking points, and yet why does it matter
what
so much?
Them,
and why is Nick Kyrgios showing more effort at this event than he is
in the middle weekend
of a major? I think he's someone who really
not just him
needs
generally,
a team
like,
environment.
What is it about?
I don't know. I mean, it's also the Davis Cup is one thing, and you're playing for the flag, and you've got the flag on your uniform, and they're playing the national anthem, and the chair umpire says, advantage, Serbia. This is like the most arbitrary distinctions. I mean, Serbia versus Switzerland may as well be Saskatchewan and Puerto Rico. Like, there's no unity Europe versus the rest of the world.
Right, and this is, I mean, talk about Davis Cup. That has, like, history. I mean, you're playing for your country. It's something that's been happening forever. This is literally... going on for 2 years. Like, there's no history here. There's nothing back in the day. Like, no one's saying, you know, it's not there yet.
Yeah, right,
so
right.
I don't...
Came out of the box strong.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest part that interests me is sort of watching the passion and the emotion. And I'm sure everyone at home is also kind of wondering the same thing as what's sort of driving these players. As you said, you know, they're getting paid the same. So, like, it's not the ranking points. It's not the money. It's not the... You know, country pride, you know, so what is it?
The other thing I got, which really intrigues me, was you really got a sense of Roger Federer as host. I don't know what you want to call it. I mean, it was sort of Roger's
really
weekend.
It was
a Roger weekend. He was very much sort of at once. You watch Succession?
No, I don't.
All right. Bad reference there. Roger was running the show, and it was clearly an event for him. I mean, I think safe to say there's a financial...
Right.
Stake for him. There's an image stake. This was sort of his event. He was very much a man about town. He was a greeter. He was very gracious as a host, and he played in the event. And what it got me thinking is, what is Roger Federer's role going to be in tennis? I mean, I say this is going to sound pejorative, but it's really not. He really knows how to work a room.
Right.
he's very gracious. He comes dressed for the occasion. You know, he saw me, he shook my hand. Thanks for coming. It was a 5-second interaction, but you walk away and you're like, oh, I love this guy.
Right.
There is a real grace and polish to him, and it got me thinking, what is his role in tennis when he is done playing? Because he's perhaps the singular, I was going to say the rare, but I think the singular person who could bring together all these forces, and he has the financial backing. You know, there's
the
millions of dollars in production. Right. I mean, that, you know, you play one night in Toledo and you don't have a spider cam and you don't have this kind of infrastructure. I mean, I think Roger.
No, but when Roger Federer calls the spider cam company and says, hey, I'm doing this.
Right. Or he brings in J.P. Morgan and suddenly has $1 million in production to play with. It's I tell you, the one thing I really got me thinking is, what does this augur? What does it say about Roger Federer's future role in tennis? Because he really has a knack for bringing, it sounds trite, but he really has a knack for bringing people together.
So once he's done playing, you think that this can sort of continue with him being a host solely and not a host and a participant, maybe.
We joke about the commissioner of tennis, and if only the sport had a commissioner, and what would a commissioner do about everything from Carlos Ramos to putting roofs on stadiums to equal prize money? I think there really might be some, if he wants it, some Mount Olympus role. I mean, there really was a sense that this was a businessman, a politician, and an athlete all at once, and he got it all to work.
Yeah, it just feels very like you get invited to, you know, the big shot's house for the weekend, and this is, you know, they put on this big party. And like you're there.
You gotta play well for the boss.
Yeah, kind of thing. It has those vibes to me. But overall, exciting. It's exciting to see what.
I did not think 10 days after the U.S. Open, tennis was going to have this kind of spot in the conversation. Anything else tennis wise you want to discuss? Naomi Osaka, nice.
Don't you think? It's nice to see her sort of get back and not pull what other players have in the past. you know, it's good. I feel like maybe she just took the trophy, put it on the shelf, close the door, back to business.
I think, and the fact that it was in Asia, I think, is significant as well. No, I think that said a lot. I mean, last year, the 2017 U.S. Open might be a particularly extreme example, but you're right. We have seen players win majors, and not unreasonably.
No,
maybe
take
some time off and regroup, and Naomi Osaka right back to work. I think that really said an awful lot. I got a little bit lost in the news. You know, again, Laver Cup was definitely the dominant tennis conversation, but nice accounting of herself by Naomi Osaka. Let's acknowledge that. All right, let's wrap. We'll do another one in a week.
Sounds good.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone. Keep the guest suggestions coming. Thanks to Paul Anacone. Thanks as always to Jamie, and have a good week, everyone.